edit 8 p.m., wake up 2 hours later at 10 p.m., 6 hours of questioning and threats, and then bed again at 4 a.m. before being roused again at 6 a.m. When she inevitably fell asleep, the guard would bang on the door or physically shake her. Eventually, he took her mattress away too. The questions for Miriam remained the same. Who put her up to it? Who conspired with her to make her foolish attempt to escape? A collective society needed collective punishment for crimes. Surely no 16-year-old girl would take it upon herself to defy the government of the German Democratic Republic. Eventually, Miriam made up some ridiculous story about a man with little feet who frequented a bar that she knew of. It was not uncommon for those under investigation to give the interrogators what they wanted, nor did the question have to resort to the more brutal tactics of Stalin's era. Their typical strategy was a straightforward and effective one. The classic scenario was the corner-to-corner interrogation room. The room was on the second floor and overlooked the edge of the prison, allowing a tantalizing glimpse of the outside world. The interrogator's chair and desk were situated at an angle to this window corner, facing into the room. When the prisoner was brought in, he was placed on an uncomfortable small stool in the far interior corner of the room so that he crouched there facing the interrogator, who was a good 10 feet away. The psychological effect, which had been thoroughly researched, was to make the prisoner instantly uncomfortable and apprehensive, subject to an animal unease, which the interrogator could increase by simply staring at him and saying things like, "I have plenty of time. I have nothing but time." It was clear to the prisoner that, just out of his line of vision, a window revealed a world he had left weeks or months previously for a lonely, silent cell. Often the prisoner felt an overwhelming sense to talk, to make something happen that would get him off that stool and out of there. Miriam was sentenced to a year and a half in prison. The very first day, the prison guards gave her introduction. Naked, she was taken to a room with a deep bathtub. One guard held her legs and the other her hair, forcing her down into ice-cold water. Over and over, they dunked her. When she was allowed to catch a breath, the guards called the teenaged girl various names. Filth. Bitch. Traitor. She began to believe that they were killing her, which was precisely the point. Nor was what happened to Miriam unique. Mental torture was developed to its acme under the regime of the German secret police. For like so many others, Miriam had fallen into the hands of the Stasi. Simon Wiesenthal made his name as a Nazi hunter, spending decades tracking down those members of the Third Reich who had managed to escape justice by fleeing abroad. His analysis of the East German secret police was a very blunt one. The Stasi was much, much worse than the Gestapo, if you consider only the oppression of its own people. The Gestapo had 40,000 officials watching a country of 80 million, while the Stasi employed 102,000 to control only 17 million. Roughly 2% of the East German population were informants, an enormously large percentage once one stops to think about it. Most humans are surprisingly low in empathy, meaning they lack the ability to see things from other people's perspectives. Westerners tend to think that if we were to inform on our neighbors, it would only be under duress or if they were doing something objectively wrong, such as harming their children. In fact, this is demonstrably not the case. There is rarely a shortage of people who will trip over themselves to inform on their countrymen without any pressure or even much tangible reward other than some sort of status or a sense of, "I'm doing my part." Some quite literally just have nothing better to do. As one Stasi recruiter said, "Well, some of them were convinced of the cause, but I think it was mainly because informers got the feeling that doing it, they were somebody. You know, someone was listening to them for a couple of hours a week, taking notes. They felt they had it over other people." It was an easy way for low-status, obedient people to become more important than they otherwise would have been. In retrospect, an enormous incentive. Many, too many, of the Stasi's informers weren't drafted so much as they were volunteers. It was pitiful, actually, the recruiter concluded. They were hardly paid at all. After the Stasi files were eventually opened, Germans were allowed to learn who had informed on them and what they had said. This was a dilemma. "I think of the now famous case of Vera Wallenberger," wrote one journalist, "a political activist, my friend, Werner Kratzschell's parish in Pankow, who discovered from reading her file that her husband, Knud, had been informing on her ever since they met. They would go for a walk with the children on Sunday, and on Monday, Knud would pour it all out to his Stasi case officer." A person can try and play out how they would feel if they learned that their spouse had been betraying them from day one, but this is purely hypothetical. Would it be akin to learning that they had had an affair on the side? Easier to deal with, since there wasn't any physical intimacy? Harder to deal with, since at least an affair can be rationalized as meaningless acts of pleasure? If they lied about this, what else did they lie about? Or is this such a specific type of lying that maybe that meant they were honest in other contexts? Was it even lying if the things they said to the Stasi were the truth? As such, there are people in Germany whose job it is to prepare citizens for what they might find in these files. Frau Trumpelmann, who has a church background, takes immense pains to help people through these shocks. She generally telephones beforehand to prepare them. She carefully explains about the nature of the files before settling them down in the reading room. She is at hand to comfort them as they read, but the strain on her is great. She has trouble with her eyes and her heart. How to work with poison every day and not yourself be poisoned. One of Frau Trumpelmann's recent readers had been imprisoned for 5 years under the communist regime for attempting to escape to the West. Now she found out, by reading her file, that it was the man she was living with who had denounced her to the Stasi. They still lived together. Only that morning, he had wished her a good day in the archive. The woman collapsed into Frau Trumpelmann's arms. Much of the Stasi's tactics seemed to come out of a spy thriller. Nowadays, people are familiar with exploding ultraviolet ink packs used to mark and deter robbers. But decades earlier, the Stasi had their own methods to secretly mark people. Radiation. They had radioactive magnets for cars, radioactive pins into clothes, radioactive pellets shot into tires. A radioactive spray could be surreptitiously used on anyone in a crowd, and if used on a floor, it could make a target unknowingly leave radioactive footprints wherever they went. These techniques were only later put together because several prisoners all died from an unusual form of cancer, which led to investigators discovering a radiation machine. It was with the rise of Walter Ulbricht's successor, Erich Honecker, that decision was made to lessen the Stasi's use of brute terror and focused on the infinitely more pernicious techniques of mental warfare. In the post-Stalin era, many dissidents in the Soviet Union and allied countries were sentenced to mental institutions for spurious reasons. You'd have to be insane to oppose the truth of communism, after all. Being a largely materialistic ideology, Marxism tends to be skeptical of psychiatry. But for those who challenged the government, Soviet authorities made an exception. Yet the Stasi did them one better with the concept of Zersetzung. Zersetzung is usually translated into English as corrosion or disintegration. The word has similarities to the American concept of gaslighting, after the film in which a husband surreptitiously convinces his wife that she is going insane and thereby trying to make it happen for real. The literal gaslighting in the film refers to his dimming lights in their home while insisting nothing had changed. What gives the German term an extra bit of sadism is that what was being corroded or disintegrated were the sane minds of those who the Stasi decided to target. Zersetzung worked by, say, coming home and finding one's socks on the pillow for no reason. Did they leave their socks out and simply forget? What about when it happened again the next day and the day after that? If someone had in fact been there, why would the socks be misplaced and all the valuables present and accounted for? The mind would have infinite questions and no answers, and no one to ask for advice or explanation. Whether the mental state that inevitably followed should be referred to as paranoia is a pedantic question, as in the adage, are you paranoid if they're really out to get you? But the Stasi often took things one step further. In a perfect inversion of Western police surveillance, they sometimes wanted a target to know they were being watched while simultaneously being completely unable to answer why. They would intentionally generate odd sounds on a target's telephone calls or make it a point to be seen speaking with one's employers. The target would then be sent into a state of justified fear, racking their brain as to what they knew and who told what. The police would often stop the target repeatedly and search them every time. These were very effective techniques for breaking up social or political groups at any time. In a nation where so many of the population were informants, the natural reaction would be to suspect whomever one happened to be spending time with the most. It went both ways. A target's newfound paranoid behavior would be sure to arouse suspicion from others. If that didn't work, the Stasi could easily plant rumors to arouse suspicion anyway. Once a person had it in their head that someone else was behaving oddly, it virtually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The mind would begin to notice perfectly innocuous things, but perceive them through the lens of suspicion. The cost-benefit analysis as to whether to further interact with such a person was clear. Better to distance oneself than possibly have one's entire life ruined. The Stasi had another technique for breaking up groups, which by their nature tended to be regarded as conspiracies against the state. All it would take was one Stasi operative in an organization urging its members toward increasingly radical and aggressive actions. All the members could then be detained for associating with aggressive radicals or not turning them in. The Stasi could then also truthfully say that the group had been an audience to illegal conversations. As insidious as the Stasi was to East Germans, it sometimes managed to extend its influence into West Germany as well. Any discontent in the GDR was routinely blamed on the relics of Hitler. An uprising of more than 1 million East Germans on June 16 and 17, 1953 was blithely defined as a fascist coup attempt. Perhaps the most reprehensible of the Stasi's schemes was something codenamed Action J, as in Jew. The Soviets had no problem finding subversive opponents in their midst, and where they could not be found, they were either invented out of thin air, or people were forced into confessing to crimes. The Stasi did the same thing, and they did it with quintessential German professionalism. First, a Stasi operative was quietly sent to West Germany to find the names of people who had publicly made anti-Semitic statements. The plan was to send Jewish Holocaust survivors letters in the name of those anti-Semites. Some of these drafted letters survived in the Stasi files. "Haven't you had enough, you Jewish pigs? We forgot to gas you. Wake up, Germany." To make matters worse, the Stasi also intended to send out fake letters from the Jewish targets of this fraudulent Nazism. I don't dare give my name out of fear, one such draft included. Single-handedly, the Stasi could invent both Nazis and Jewish victims. As one senior party official put it at the time, the destabilization in West Germany was necessary even at the risk that some Jews would suffer from it. Radicalism, even neo-Nazi radicalism, was viewed as a useful cudgel with which to denigrate the rival West Germany. Indeed, in a masterpiece of propaganda and brazen bullshit, the GDR acted for decades as if Nazism had been largely or exclusively a West German phenomenon and that the East Germans had been rescued from Nazism by the Russians. Immediately after World War II, a monument was put up in eastern Dresden in what was briefly called Red Army Square before being more subtly renamed Unity Square. The inscription read, "Eternal glory to the fighters of the Red Army who fell in the battles against the German fascist conquerors for the freedom and independence of the Soviet homeland." Yet the Stasi agents weren't freed themselves either. Once you were in the Stasi, there was no exit. Funder tells a nightmarish story of one Stasi agent who tried to resign. At one point, he had assembled a few pamphlets for a friend's wedding. Unauthorized printing being a crime, the Stasi tracked him down from the typewriter that he used at work and arrested him for being a pornographer, even though there was nothing risque in the pamphlets. Then, the Stasi went to the agent's wife and accused her of being in on her husband's pornography career, both to her utter terror and very appropriate confusion. Pornography was a serious felony, and the two had a son. When she was questioned, the district attorney merely asked her, "Is there anyone who could look after your little boy for the next 5 years or so?" The only way to save herself and her custody of her son was to distance herself from her husband by applying for a divorce. Helpfully, the DA had brought such an application with him, already filled out with all of her and her husband's information. All she had to do was sign, which she, of course, did. The Stasi then went to see the agent in jail in order to tell him, truthfully, that his wife had signed a paper asking for divorce. Look, he could see for himself, there was her signature. So, did he want to reconsider the matter of his resignation? After all, he had operational knowledge and he couldn't simply be allowed to leave the organization. And now that he was rid of that bad influence wife, why, if he remained, he would be eligible for promotion. He, of course, reconsidered. After his release, the agent refused to listen to his ex-wife's explanations, the woman who left him hanging when he had been his lowest. It was only months later, when their 5-year-old son explained to his father what had happened, that he put two and two together. The Stasi had never even bothered to repair the family that they destroyed in order to get what they wanted. Yet as sinister and feared as his Stasi were, East Germany's leader Erich Honecker was still not the most hated figure in the GDR. That honor would probably belong to the woman who became his third wife and longtime partner in crime, Margot Honecker. Just as it was Ilse Koch who was despised as the bitch of Buchenwald over her camp commander husband Karl Otto, Margot gained a reputation for cruelty and oppression all on her own. Unusually in communist circles, and in democratic ones as well, Margot had become a prominent politician in her own right before hitching her wagon to Herr Honecker's. The communist countries had youth movements to prepare future party cadres, and East Germany's Free German Youth was co-founded by Erich in 1946. 3 years later, Margot Feist became the youngest member of parliament at the ripe age of 22. The pair crossed paths and began an affair despite the fact that he was 15 years her elder and already married. After Margot gave birth to their daughter Sonia in 1952, Walter Ulbricht strongly encouraged Honecker to get a divorce and marry Margot. Being a dutiful German, Honecker followed orders. Margot Honecker became Minister of National Education in 1963, while Erich replaced Ulbricht as East German leader in 1971. And while Honecker and his regime dominated the adult citizens in the German Democratic Republic, it was Margot's role to come for the children. This earned her the German nickname of Die Hexe, the witch. Undeniably beautiful and often smiling, Margot was a bit of a fashionista in a time and a place where wearing conspicuous clothing was more than a bit suspect. At one point, she took things a step further and began to dye her graying hair an unnatural shade of lilac, whereupon Die Hexe became known as the Purple Witch. Rumors circulated that she flew to Paris every month to get her hair done. Margot's job was to make sure that East German children grew up to be loyal, obedient citizens, or else. Part of her plan was to make sure that the kids had reliable homes to grow up in. Her definition of reliability was, of course, the degree to which parents were in line with the reigning communist ideology. It only took applying for a visa to leave East Germany, even for just a trip, to mark someone as unreliable or downright hostile to the GDR, for example. One couldn't very well have such types working in an office environment where they could corrupt others. It made sense to fire them. Having the mark of getting fired on one's record would lead to the virtual impossibility of a new job. The official position of the German Democratic Republic was that unemployment did not exist there. People weren't unemployed, they were looking for work. Therefore, if someone was never able to find a job in the fully employed country, logically speaking, it must be due to that antisocial individual's stubborn refusal to work. Antisocial individuals have no business raising children, and the definition of antisocial ranged from being out of work to some other sense of not fitting in with the greater East German society. The GDR took thousands of kids from unreliable parents and gave them to good communists to raise as their own. Any further contact between parents and their children was impossible, for they had no idea where their kids went. Sometimes the government wouldn't bother to wait a week before taking newborn infants away. Even the mothers in the gulag decades prior had better opportunities with their babies. If any parent was a threat to the Honecker regime in any way, their children could also be saved from their clutches by being imprisoned by the government. It was a devious way to ensure that parents were obedient. Every single East German child was effectively a hostage of the government at all times, an extreme measure even by communist standards. Some parents spent decades trying to track down what happened to their offspring with various degrees of success. Sometimes they learned their adult children were no longer interested in seeing them for whatever reason. Others met and stared at one another, two strangers who only had their biology in common. The crucial bonds made when a child is very young are almost impossible to reestablish at a later date. Yet these forced adoptions weren't Margot's most horrific technique, nor was it her ideologically driven curricula meant to raise generations of perfect communist East German children. The most notorious of her tools for control was in Torgau. A two-hour drive south from Berlin, Torgau is a town in Saxony that stands on the banks of the River Elbe. It was there on April 25, 1945, where the United States and USSR anti-Nazi forces came together from west and east respectively, shaking hands for the first time. In this sense, the town of Torgau can be seen as a symbol of dawn, of knowing that the worst is over and that victory lies ahead. It was at Torgau that Margot ran the worst of the Jugendwerkhof in East Germany. Though the word means youth workshop, the reality was that Torgau was a prison for children. One can argue whether the conditions at Torgau were worse than a standard prison or merely the same. What is indisputable is that 12-year-olds are not very compatible with being held in solitary confinement, and not for murder or terrorism or the other extreme crimes people tend to associate with solitary confinement. One teenage survivor described being locked up after her stepfather molested her, driving her to attempt suicide. She was nevertheless imprisoned like all the others. Children who are suicidal in the United States are institutionalized just as they were in East Germany, but the East German version of institutionalization is enormously different from the American. The children at Torgau were locked in with no possibility of escape, without any contact with their families, with no hope of someone letting them out of their 65 square foot room, no matter what they did. They knew that if they panicked or acted out or screamed for help, that would only make conditions worse. And if they didn't know, they learned that very, very quickly. Margot's staff was there to make sure of that. When they first arrived at Torgau, the children would be kept in holding cells. They would have to wait several days for the director to bother seeing them. While they waited, they weren't allowed to sing or whistle or to make any noise at all, nor were they allowed to even look out the window. That was a whole other world, one that no longer concerned them. The goal was not to save the imprisoned children, but to break them, because deviation from the crowd in any sense put them on the radar screen of the authorities. While it takes quite a bit to lock up an American young person against his or her will, especially if their parents are opposed as well, in the GDR it took relatively little. And just as with any other environment, the predators knew to go where the prey was. And the more helpless the prey, the easier it was for the predators. Not only could the Torgau caretakers assault the children who were ostensibly under their care, they were permitted to take the children home with them on weekends to use however they wanted in the privacy of their own homes. As German newsweekly Der Spiegel reported, not everyone could endure the conditions. A 17-year-old who ran away from Torgau while being transported was so desperate that he jumped into the Elbe River and drowned. Young people used shirts to hang themselves, drank industrial grease, and swallowed needles. One boy locked himself in his room, poured floor wax all over his body, and set himself on fire. Another teenager tried to sacrifice himself so that others could run away. He told his fellow inmates to kill him and hang his body from the bars on the window of the dormitory to lure the guards into the room. The boy was strangled with a sheet to the point of unconsciousness, but he survived. The attempted escape failed. In a sense, Torgau can be taken as an extreme metaphor for all the people on the far side of the Berlin Wall, or even on the far side of the Iron Curtain. These populations were trapped both literally and figuratively, with no hope of escape, living in countries where human life was nothing, less than nothing, and they knew it. Indeed, what possible argument for hope could there be? There had been opportunities for escape as the years passed, but they had all failed. The time after Stalin's death was one such example. Imre Nagy was the Prime Minister of Hungary from 1953 to 1955. When Stalin passed away, Nagy attempted to soften his government's authoritarianism. This displeased the Kremlin, and he was pulled from his position. Then came Khrushchev's secret speech in early 1956, which led to widespread Hungarian unrest. Nagy was returned to power in an attempt to mollify the population, but it did little to ease the tensions. For 13 days, Hungary stood in full revolt against being a Soviet satellite. Nagy announced that his country would be withdrawn drawing from the Warsaw Pact, and that was a bridge too far for Khrushchev. Criticism of Stalin was permitted, if not downright encouraged, throughout the communist nations, but defiance of Soviet power was still forbidden. On November 4, 1956, the Soviets launched a full invasion of Hungary. Nagy was arrested alongside many others who took part in the uprising, and a new administration, in lockstep with Moscow, was installed in his place. He was then imprisoned and tortured for almost 2 years before eventually being hanged in 1958. Nor was that the only example. January 5, 1968 witnessed Alexander Dubcek assuming the leadership